Support for this podcast comes from Washington Wise, an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Decisions made in Washington affect your portfolio and your money every day. But what policy changes should investors be watching? Washington Wise is an original podcast for investors from Charles Schwab. The show unpacks the stories making news in Washington and how they may affect your finances and investments. Listen today at schwab.com/washingtonwise. That's schwab.com/washingtonwise.
Hi, we're Visible. We're the wireless company with nothing to hide. Seriously. Hidden fees? We don't have them. Annual contracts? Not our thing. Great wireless on just one line? Now that's more like it. Get unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon for just $25 a month. Taxes and fees included. That's right, $25 a month, every month. Sorry, hidden fees. We're just not that into you. Sometimes the choice is just Visible. Switch today at Visible.com. Rate with service on the Visible plan. For additional terms and network management practices, see Visible.com.
For today's episode, we've got Representative Ro Khanna from California. This is a really interesting congressman who has a lot of big ideas. Today, we're going to focus in specifically on a big idea he has to sort of bring federalism into the Medicare for All debate. This is not really something the presidential candidates have been talking about, but I think it's really interesting if you want to think about what's a politically practical route forward. Fascinating conversation. Check it out. Hello, welcome to another episode of The Weeds on the Vox Media Podcast Network. I'm Matthew Iglesias. My guest today, Representative Ro Khanna, is from the California 17th Congressional District that is out in the Silicon Valley area, basically. Is that? Yeah. And he has a bill that we wanted to talk about. It's called the State-Based Universal Healthcare Act. And the basic idea of this is to lay the groundwork for states to create sort of single-payer healthcare plans of their own. Is that right?
Exactly. One of the obstacles to states pursuing single-payer has been that they haven't had the revenue. Many states have constitutions that don't allow them to deficit spend. When Vermont tried it, they were not able to use the Medicare or Medicaid money, and that the numbers just didn't work up. So this bill, very simply put, would let states use their federal money to institute a single-payer bill, provided that they cover 95% of people with a goal of covering 100% within 5 years, and provided they provide better benefits than the current federal program.
And so the basic issue here, right, is under our current, like, fragmented system, the federal government is still a very big player in healthcare financing, right?
Yeah.
So you look at Medicare primarily, then Medicaid, Affordable Care Act subsidies. It's like the federal government is a giant share of the spending. So in any kind of plan, you want to like reuse that money, right?
Exactly.
And currently, if you're a state government, if you're, you know, a liberal state and you're like, okay, you know, Senate's not going for this Medicare for All thing, but maybe we will in California, right? Your problem is you're paying into the federal system.
Right.
And you would need to get a lot of waivers approved by HHS.
Correct. You would have to get all those waivers approved. And for practical purposes, you couldn't use the $360 billion or so that in California, the Medicare, Medicaid federal funding is. You wouldn't have access to that. This would allow you to have access for that funding. Now, some economists fairly have said that maybe that's not enough, even if you got the federal waiver, and you could consider supplemental funding based on the insurance gap. So in California, it's about 9% of people aren't covered. You could say, okay, the federal government, in addition to allowing the waivers, should provide states that are going to hit this goal supplemental federal matching funds. The point, though, is that when you talk to Vermont's governor who tried single payer, or when you talk to people in Massachusetts or California about why they aren't getting this done, it's the numbers, and this bill would make the numbers work.
And so currently, you could get those waivers on a sort of discretionary basis, right?
You could, but from a practical perspective, you know, it would have to be piecemeal, and you would have to get ERISA waivers, and it would be a cumbersome process. This would make it very clear that if you had a plan that you gave HHS that said, you have 95% coverage and you're providing better benefits, then you get all at once, you get the waiver.
So since the show is called The Weeds, let's talk about ERISA waivers.
Yes.
Because I think that's probably something, you know, even people who know Medicare, know Medicaid, are maybe not familiar with this.
So ERISA is basically, if you're a public employee plan or a pension plan, then there are requirements that ERISA regulates in terms of the regulation of those plans. And so if you want to be providing health care to people who are in those pension plans, then you need a waiver that it's not going to be governed by ERISA, and this does that.
Right. So the idea of ERISA is to prevent people from getting their pensions and other things sort of ripped off.
Exactly.
Right? And so in the spirit of ERISA, you could give people a Medicare for All type program instead of the health insurance that they've been purchasing. But by the letter of the law, you couldn't do that. People have their plans, and so a state government saying, oh, no, here we have this new thing would violate that.
Right. And you could see a certain concern. I mean, if a state government was not run by a progressive governor and you didn't have the right standards, one could say, are they trying to take advantage of these retirees and these pensioners and provide some below quality health care? And so we want to regulate it. And that's why the key in the bill is the requirement that the benefits be better than what they're getting from the federal provided plans.
Right. I mean, because we talk sort of all the time, people talk loosely about universal health insurance, right?
Right.
But I mean, health insurance can mean a lot of things. We were just doing our benefit selections here. And,
right,
you know, we have like three different plans we can pick from.
Right.
One of them is really cheap, but like it's also garbage. And so the idea of this is you can't say, okay, we're getting all these waivers and we're giving everyone insurance, quote unquote, that has a $15,000 deductible.
Exactly. Or that isn't going to cover you if you need, God forbid, cancer treatment, or if you're in the hospital for 60 days. It's got to at least be what Medicare currently is providing. Now, we can believe, and I believe, that Medicare needs to be strengthened and cover long-term care and hearing. And we could increase Medicare. But if Medicare is strengthened at the federal level, then they would have to make sure that the states were providing better benefits.
Okay. So the standard in your legislation is pegged to current Medicare.
All right. It's pegged to the current benefits, the highest benefits that of a plan that is, the federal dollars are going mm-hmm. to. So Medicare benefits are better than Medicaid benefits. So it would be current Medicare. It has to be better than current Medicare. Mm-hmm.
And so I know, I mean, this is something that I know trips people up because Medicare for All, as
yes.
it's discussed in politics, is actually describing a program that's in a lot of ways significantly more generous than the existing Medicare program.
Yes. I mean, Medicare. So for example, Medicaid, not Medicare, covers long-term care,
mm-hmm.
right? So this is why you hear the stories of seniors who may have someone who has Alzheimer's or someone who needs long-term care literally having to go bankrupt before they get coverage because Medicare doesn't cover it than Medicaid does.
And Medicaid has an assets test, right? So you
right.
have to
yeah,
you
so
have to spend down or somehow get rid of everything in order to get those benefits.
Exactly. And you basically almost have to go to the level of bankruptcy. I mean, not literal bankruptcy, but bankrupting your life savings. So one of the things that Jayapal's bill or Sanders' bill, Jayapal in the House, does is it says Medicare should be covering long-term care. Medicare also should be covering dental costs. Medicare should be covering hearing costs. So part of Medicare for All's debate is, do we expand the benefits of Medicare? And then, of course, it's reducing the copays. I mean, Medicare still can have fairly high copays in certain situations of hospitalization. So that's the first point. And then the second point is, of course, expanding the coverage of Medicare beyond people who are 65.
Right. But so in your bill, a state could go for a program that's comparable to Medicare's coverage
Correct.
Rather than to the more generous Medicare for All scheme. So you're trying to make sure that you get something better
get
than the current coverage, but not necessarily that full sort of benefits package from the Medicare for All legislation.
Correct, because there would be no way to define that at a federal. I mean, I suppose you could preemptively define it, but then you would have to give more funding. I mean, you couldn't say
right.
Use the same funding to get better to get better benefits. So as long as they're giving the same benefits, and this is a way so you don't have people scaring seniors saying, oh, you're going to lose something. Mm-hmm. You're going to at least get what you have.
And so I should be clear in case people don't know you. You are a proponent of the sort of main Jayapal's Medicare for All bill in the House.
I'm a huge proponent. I mean, and partly, look, Ted Kennedy, as we were talking before the podcast, had this bill in 1971. Mm-hmm. In 71, Jimmy Carter ran on a single-payer bill in 1976. And so this is long overdue. I believe it's the only way you're going to actually reduce costs from 17% of healthcare, which is currently GDP. It's the only way to get costs down, and it's the only way to improve benefits. And so to me, that is what makes economic sense. It's what makes moral sense. But to get to there, I think we want states to be laboratories of innovation, like you had in Canada, where you had Saskatchewan, the province, start with single payer, and then it became more widely adopted.
Right. So this is interesting because we've seen, you know, a lot of different candidates, a lot of different bills, ideas about sort of more incremental steps to, right, to expanding coverage. And so the philosophy that you're taking here is somewhat different from these other kinds of things, right? Is to say essentially, well, we need to facilitate a single-payer program in one state. And so I wonder, or, you know, could be more than one state.
Right.
But what sort of makes you think that that's a smart approach to take?
I think we need all of the above approach. So if tomorrow we have a progressive president who puts Medicare for All before a Congress and Senate and we can pass it with a transition plan, I think that's ideal. But Senator Warren just came out with a view that she would do this in year three of her presidency. So what are we doing those first 2 years? Well, it would be great if on day one of a progressive president, they signed this bill and allowed a California or a Massachusetts to pass single payer and show that as a laboratory of democracy, it's working. And so this is something that can allow states to innovate and have a single payer approach while we work simultaneously on federal legislation.
And from a federal perspective, this bill would not require any new revenue, right?
It would not. I mean, look, I just want to be fair about it. I believe that you can get there based on just the transfer of funding from the federal program. Some economists have looked at this and said, no, you're going to need a little bit more revenue. And so you could argue that you may need some supplemental federal funding for the insurance gap, but it's not significant.
Right. But I mean, the point is this you could potentially get a member of Congress who doesn't want to vote for legislation that will increase taxes.
Yes.
Might say, okay, well, I can vote for Khanna's bill. Because
yeah,
it doesn't do that. And then it kicks down to some state where, you know, it, more progressive public opinion, more progressive governor wants to take that challenge on.
Absolutely. And it allows the math to work for that progressive governor to be able to do it because it's almost impossible to get the numbers to work without that federal funding. The interesting thing is the National Review, a conservative publication, basically criticized my plan saying, okay, it's a federalist approach. We like that, but they're not federalists when it comes to conservative solutions. So they're only federalists when it comes to lefty solutions like single payer. The National Review ended up having to issue a correction because, as I pointed out, I said it doesn't actually mandate a single payer system. Mm-hmm. What it says is a state has to have 95% coverage and better benefits than the existing federal program. So if you can figure out a magical conservative way of doing that, I don't know a one, but it would qualify. So it's actually something that even conservatives should get behind on a federalist principle because it's only prescribing the goals, not the means.
I think they're probably not going to get behind it, though.
You never know. You never know. But it does give the ability of a Joe Manchin or a Coons in Delaware to get behind it. I could see a Democratic caucus getting behind this approach.
Right. I mean, that's what seems to be the advantage, is that yeah, it lets a more cautious or more moderate or more politically whatever Democrat do it and sort of pass the buck then to California and New York and Massachusetts and other places.
And the second thing it does, candidly, is every governor who's running on single payer, and there have been a lot, including in my states, then can't just say, oh, what we're going to do is send a letter in to Donald Trump to say we want a federal waiver and until then we don't do anything. No, go pass a single payer system like the campaigns called for and have a trigger be, okay, this will go into effect when there is a federal waiver.
All right. With that, let's take a break. And then I do want to talk about that state politics.
Support for The Weeds comes from Not Another Politics Podcast from the Harris School of Public Policy. With the constant news cycle, there's a lot of noise out there. Opinions are plastered all over social media, pundits are throwing out hot takes without any sort of context, and it's only getting worse as we dive farther into election season. We know that if you're listening to us at The Weeds, you're looking to cut through all this. And if you like this show, you might like Not Another Politics Podcast. Not Another Politics Podcast is produced by the University of Chicago Harris School of Public Policy. They want to take a research and data approach to analyzing hot button issues and offer perspectives that go beyond the headlines. They cover a wide variety of topics in their episodes, but a few recent episodes that you can listen to include a deep dive into why women are underrepresented in U.S. politics or whether or not we can believe political surveys. You can listen and subscribe today at harris.uchicago.edu/NAPP. That's N-A-P-P.
Hi, we're Visible. We're the wireless company with nothing to hide. Seriously. Hidden fees? We don't have them. Annual contracts? Not our thing. Great wireless on just one line? Now that's more like it. Get unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon for just $25 a month. Taxes and fees included. That's right, $25 a month, every month. Sorry, hidden fees. We're just not that into you. Sometimes the choice is just Visible. Switch today at Visible.com. Rate with service on the Visible plan. For additional terms and network management practices, see Visible.com.
As you were just mentioning there, we now have in the bluer states, in California, a lot of elected officials sort of nominally committed to creating state-based single-payer plans. Do you think people would really move forward if this federal framework were put in place?
Yes, and that was the purpose of my bill, is to say in California, for example, the California State Senate has already passed a single payer. The California nurses are behind it. The governor, Governor Newsom, ran saying he was going to make single payer one of his highest priorities. This bill says, okay, you can act, California. Don't wait. Act. You can make it contingent on a federal waiver. Mm-hmm. You can put that into the legislation. But don't wait until we get a progressive president to start the process.
Mm-hmm. So how do you sort of envision this then working at a state level? Do you think states can act to bring down the sort of payment rates in the way that Sanders and Warren and others seem to be anticipating in their schemes here?
I do, especially a state as big as California. I mean, you could have a savings when it comes to administrative costs. You know, in Palo Alto, for example, the Palo Alto Medical Foundation, they literally have 40 people employed just to maximize billing, to try to figure out how do you maximize billing for different procedures. Well, in a single-payer system, you wouldn't need that. You can reduce the hospital facility fees. You could reduce pharmaceutical costs. So I think that there would be an extraordinary amount of savings, and you use that money then to cover more people and provide them with better benefits.
So do you think states can reduce pharmaceutical payments in the same way? Because, I mean, in all these plans I've seen, right, one of the things they envision
right.
is the federal government doing some kind of bargaining or price control the way foreign countries do.
Right.
But states don't seem to take that path currently.
I think it's harder for states, certainly harder for smaller states to have as much leverage. But I think a state like California, where you're talking about 35 million people almost, would have a significant amount of bargaining ability. Now, drug prices are a bit tougher because, you know, they're still competing with 49 other states. And, you know, maybe some drug companies would threaten to boycott the California market if they move too aggressively, whereas you can't boycott the United States market. So I acknowledge that states have slightly less leverage, mm-hmm. and that's why ultimately we need a federal solution. But I think there's nothing stopping a few progressive states from implementing this. I mean, Romney Care in Massachusetts was what led to the Affordable Care Act.
Mm-hmm.
And so you could either have a smaller state do it where it may be logistically easier, or a very blue state like mine in California do it where we've got plenty of billionaires and we've got plenty of corporations that could help share some of the burden.
Well, and California is you know, it's the largest state. So it makes it unusual in this regard,
right?
I mean, California has roughly the population of Canada,
right,
larger than many European countries,
right,
and so probably has a degree of leverage
right.
that, you know, a Vermont or somebody lacks, right? I mean, with the auto companies and the emissions regulation, this has been a thing ongoing, right? But, like, when California sets a market standard, oftentimes companies have to meet it
right.
when they might walk away from a smaller state.
Right. And this was the case of the privacy law, the California privacy law, which basically is right now serving as the regulatory environment for the entire country. So I do think California, with its population size and the fact that it's the sixth largest economy, 15% of American U.S. GDP, has a fair amount of leverage, particularly on hospitals, particularly on costs of providers, and to some extent on pharmaceuticals as well.
All right. So you think this has a better chance of passing in Congress
yes.
than some of the more far-reaching bills that you've signed on to?
Well, I think all of the bills have a chance of passing. It requires the right political moment and
right.
president. But I think this one can unify the Democratic caucus, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think I could see a case where Bernie Sanders is president in 2020 or someone else is president, and you have this bill come up, the House votes for it, and a progressive president could get this through the Senate. So that's the advantage.
Right. And do you think, you know, I mean, if a state was to go and do this, right, or a few, what kind of impact do you think that has on the kind of national dialogue, right? Does that like stall momentum or build it?
Well, I think partly they need to do it well. But I think if they can show that they've reached universal coverage, if they can show that people are saving money because they don't have these exorbitant premiums that they're having to pay, that they don't have these high copays, and that they're getting better coverage, then that becomes an impetus for federal regulation and federal legislation. I mean, that's what happened with Saskatchewan in Canada. And that's what has happened in some ways with the Medicaid expansion debate, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, people have seen even in red states, well, why are we being left out of Medicaid expansion? This makes no sense. And it's what happened in Medicaid. I think Arizona adopted Medicaid in 1982, right?
Mm-hmm.
So having some states move, and if there's a good experience with it, I think creates the right incentive. Now, the opposite happened with Vermont, which Republicans have used as these absurd talking points, saying, well, Vermont tried it and it didn't work. They don't tell you that there weren't this waiver in place. And
mm-hmm.
if you talk to the governor who implemented it, he will tell you that if this waiver existed, he would have been able to do it.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is an interesting, you know, model of change that I think has fallen out of a lot of people's heads. In Canada, though, as you say, I mean, I think a lot of American sort of single-payer activists are inspired by the Canadian example. And this did start in one of the smaller Canadian
right.
provinces. And they had, you know, they had some real struggles making it work at first. We did an episode, I think, about the doctors in Saskatchewan went on strike. It wasn't like a trivial problem, but making it work there is what laid the foundation for the bigger program.
Absolutely. And there's no doubt, and it would be naive to think when you have a transition to a system that you're not going to have certain kinks that have to be worked out. And of course, you're going to have to be bringing down costs, so there are going to be people who are going to be upset. I mean, if I was a CEO of a hospital, I would probably be upset about my compensation. If I was a pharmaceutical company, I'd be upset. If I was an insurance company, I would be upset. So all of that can be worked out at a state level. And the advantage is also this is probably going to happen in a blue state where you also have the largest political will to do it and to take on those fights, which are easier in a blue state than if you have to be fighting in the entire country all at once.
Right. I mean, it lets you sort of have a little more room for maneuver if you have a population and a set of elected officials who are more enthusiastic, right? You can get things done.
Right. And look, I believe Medicare for All ultimately will deal with the cost equation, not having our healthcare costs be more than 17% of GDP. I believe ultimately it's going to allow better benefits. But the one thing that is incontrovertible is it's going to cover more people. It's
mm-hmm.
going to cover people who don't have good healthcare. And if you come from a blue state where that is a huge value, that put aside the cost argument and put aside the argument on better benefits, but we just as a moral matter believe everyone should have health care, then you're going to have more people willing to fight and look at the kinks and say, okay, the kinks are worth it because health care is a human right, than if you're coming at it just from a cost perspective and benefits for the middle class perspective and don't have that moral consideration. And so the blue states, I think you have a better chance of working out the kinks.
And so speaking of which, why is the threshold 95% coverage? That's a lot of people, but
right.
it's not 100% of people. Well, what's your thinking on that?
Well, it gets to 100% within 5 years. So it says, you know, when you're starting out on that first year, to require 100% when the insurance gap in California right now is 9%. So it would be 4% better than the current insurance gap is a pretty big lift already. I think it would be—
Insurance gap. I'm just meaning the number of people.
The number of people who are not insured, who don't have insurance, mm-hmm. which is much higher in a state like Texas than California. But even California, there are about 9%, the last I looked, 8 to 9% of people in California who have no health insurance. This would say at least get it to 95%.
So actually, why is it so high in California now? Because in Texas, they haven't expanded Medicaid. So this is a huge uninsured population accounted for by that. But what's going on in California?
You know, I don't want to give a false answer. I mean, I imagine that some of it may be the undocumented population. Mm-hmm. Some of it may be people who can't afford the Affordable Care Act and the premiums. Some of it may be people who just don't want to buy healthcare insurance given the cost of premiums and make that decision and are okay getting the penalty, which isn't enforced as much. But there are a number of reasons for it, and which is why— You know, I think the New York Times article was done by a colleague of yours, and she had an economist, which I thought the most legitimate criticism, which I mentioned a couple times, is even with this federal money, maybe that's not enough to get 100%, and which is why I think, in addition, we should be open to federal matching funds for a state that is really going to make 100% coverage.
But so in a more diverse state like California, though, it seems like to get even to 95, much less 100, you are going to have to give benefits to the undocumented population, right?
Yes, and the bill says residents, similarly to Sanders' bill and to Pramila's bill in the House. It says it will cover all residents, which means that some of those people will be undocumented.
Right. So, I mean, that's a tough issue politically, I think, for a lot of members.
It is.
Maybe not in California.
Maybe not. But again, this is one of the reasons I think states can do it. Mm-hmm. And the residents it's an ambiguous term. So I suppose you could have a plan that a state, you know, it would be up to the Health and Human Services Secretary to approve. My guess is the politics of California would include people who are undocumented, but I imagine a state could not include it, and I don't necessarily think it would be rejected just based on that. Mm-hmm. It would be on the discretion of the president's policy. But you could see a president saying, well, I want to improve coverage, and I'm not going to disapprove a plan just because of that.
Right. All right, let's take another break here, and then I want to ask some more philosophical questions here. So we were talking sort of before the show about cost estimates on these kind of plans, and I take it you are more optimistic about the potential savings of a single payer system than some of the talk that's out there.
I am. I mean, I guess I just look at it very intuitively. If you're taking out the marketing costs and you're taking out the administrative costs and you're taking out the excessive insurance profits and you're taking out the pharmaceutical costs, why wouldn't you save money? And the argument is increased utilization. I mean, mm-hmm. you look at all these models, and their argument is the reason you're not saving as much money is increased utilization. Let's just be clear what that means. They're saying you're not saving money because more people are going to get health care. I mean, and doesn't that mean that that may lead to better preventive care and better outcomes? And back in the 1970s, Richard Nixon's Health and Human Services scored Ted Kennedy's single-payer bill and made an assumption that it was going to be 66% of national healthcare expenditure. And today, for example, the Warren bill, healthcare plan, she's making an assumption, or some of these, or Sanders, they're often assuming 120% or 130% of national health expenditure, meaning that it's going to cost even more than the current system because more people are going to utilize it and inflation. I think that we would be pleasantly surprised. I think you can have far more savings than the current models anticipate.
So, I mean, essentially what we're saying is so unit costs go down in everybody's understanding of this.
Yes.
But then also, I mean, by design, like the goal is for more people to get healthcare than currently are. So utilization goes up. And there's a question of how do those factors sort of balance. Something I always wonder about this is where does the extra utilization come from? Because
That's a great point.
I meet a lot of people who have struggles with employment, never like a surgeon, right?
Right.
Who's like, can't find a job anywhere.
Right.
And so if lots more people are getting medical care, like where does that care literally occur?
You mean where does it occur with doctors and hospitals and nurses?
Yeah.
Well, I think we would need to be funding more hospitals in minority communities, more rural hospitals, more Indian health services. We need more doctors. We need more nurses. I think there is definitely the case that we're going to need more medical professionals and more medical facilities, which is why I think ultimately it will be job creating in addition to providing better benefits. Now, in some cases, in rural hospitals, in some cases, the fact that you're going to have many more people come in may just help the revenue of that hospital, and they have much more capacity than they currently have patients.
Right. I mean, we've had a trend in rural areas toward there not being enough demand to sustain medical facilities. Then they're closing, and then that makes it harder for people to kind of live in the area, right?
Exactly.
And so this kind of provision could help, like, set a floor, at least, under that kind of thing.
Absolutely. And the Medicare for All plans that Bernie Sanders, Pramila have especially focused grants to rural hospitals to keep them open, and different Medicare reimbursement rates for rural hospitals to keep them open. And, of course, this will increase the patient demand, so you don't have to have consolidation and drive out an hour. But the point you raise is actually a practical, very good one, because all of these, whether it's the Bernie plan or whichever Medicare for All plan, there does need to be thought about how do you get more doctors, how do you get more nurses, how do you get more hospitals, how do you just increase the capacity of the country to provide this care.
Right. I mean, because in your district, right, is not rural. And everything, I mean, not just healthcare, right, but like everything that's happening in the Valley comes down to supply constraints at this point, right? I mean, there's housing supply difficulties,
right.
There's transportation difficulties. I have never gone to the hospital in Palo Alto, but I mean, I assume it's the same thing, right? I mean, it's not like the hospitals are shutting down for lack of patients, right? The question is, like, can nurses like commute to the hospital? How are we going to get care to people who need it?
Right. No, I mean, obviously, that we have a huge housing problem, and the problem is that people are having to commute on salaries of under $100,000, which probably are nurses from an hour and a half away. I mean, that's a broader issue that our region has to solve, which is to figure out how do we get tech companies to create jobs in other parts of the state and other parts of the country. How do we have more affordable housing? But to your point, it is going to have to be part of a Medicare for All fix. If we get people in my district, more people having access to health care, we're going to have to figure out where we're going to house the additional nurses, where we're going to have to house additional people doing some of the clerical tasks at hospitals.
Mm-hmm. And so do you think there are things we could do to expand the supply of doctors, for example, stuff we should do along those lines?
I've been looking into it. I mean, one of the questions is, can you have targeted immigration of doctors linked to areas that need them, mm-hmm. and nurses. So there may be certain areas where we want to have a lot of doctors and nurses coming from overseas. So the other thing is, we probably want to expand with the AMA, the number of medical schools and doctors and nurses that we're graduating, and figure out how we structurally get that change. Now, that's probably politically tough.
I mean, I think a lot of people don't know this, right?
Yeah.
But so the actual, like, number of new residency slots is capped.
It's capped. It's a natural monopoly.
By law. And so as a result, I mean, it's actually fascinating if you look at the MCAT scores of new doctors has been going up and up and up.
I didn't know that.
And the number of men admitted to medical school keeps going down because more women can go into the profession, which is good. But the way it works now, it's like every new doctor, like, literally squeezes out an old one. And I mean, maybe our current generation of doctors is like way smarter than the ones from 30 years ago, but they seem fine in the past. And, you know, a lot of people like could use the extra health care.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think we have to think smartly about expanding the number of doctors, nurses, and of course, especially with the role of artificial intelligence and technology, right? I mean, so much of radiology or certain functions may be able to be done by computers, which actually may make it that you can have more doctors doing other tasks that won't be automated. So the role of technology also, I think, is an interesting is part of the equation.
Are you optimistic about that? You think we can have some real kind of technical breakthroughs that help with healthcare supply?
I am. I mean, there's a company by District that is working on a artificial intelligence technology to read the scans of people, women who go in to see if they have breast cancer. Well, it turns out, and my understanding, obviously not as a doctor, but what this person was telling me about his company, it turns out that the false positive is huge on women when they go in for a scan for breast cancer. And then it often takes a month or 2 months until you get verification. Well, if you could, and it takes two doctors looking at these scans. Well, if you just made one of those doctors automated, artificial intelligence, you still have a human review. You A, decrease the amount of time that someone would be given a false positive, and you increase the actual reliability of the test, and you're able to do a lot more patients. So there are, I think, uses of technology that can be very promising.
Yeah, and I mean, ultimately, right, I mean, this is what people want, right? It's not just to be able to go see a doctor,
right,
but to get, like, effective treatment, right? I mean, like, to get a screening and be told quickly that you're okay is, like, that's way better than you got to wait 2 months and get a subsequent test, right? I mean,
right,
it's like that's what it's about on some level, is like actually getting our health problems taken care of.
Absolutely. And the other thing is it would bring some standard in terms of billing, right? I mean, for example, there's some insurance companies that if you are a doctor and you email your patient, you can't bill that. There are others that you can bill it. And so some doctors have this perverse incentive. I mean, no matter how good of a doctor you are, if you're not going to get charged for an email correspondence, you're probably going to be more likely to say, come on in and see me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think one of the things you could do with a single-payer system is have certain standard practices that at least are incentivizing the right behavior. And we may, as a society, say, no, for certain things, we don't want email communication. We want the doctor to see the person. For other things, we may say, no, the email or remote communication is fine.
Right, right. So the issue here is communications methods have changed.
Yep.
It could be that the most efficient way to understand a problem is, like, you just sit at your desk, you ask your doctor a question, you know, on email, whatever else, they get back to you. Nobody needs to take time off. Nobody needs a long office visit. But if you're a doctor, like, you need to be able to get paid for your work.
Right.
And if you can get reimbursed for an office visit but can't get reimbursed for spending an hour answering 10 emails, then, like, you have a problem.
Exactly. And most economists will tell you, regardless of whether you feel that a visit should be compensated over email, and most people probably feel like they should, you should at least have one standard. And having one standard instead of three or four different standards with different incentives is just economically more efficient. And, you know, the chairman of the Fed, who's not liberal, yesterday was at the budget committee, and he made this point three times. He said, we spend 17% of our GDP on healthcare, far more, almost double most other Western democracies. And as he put it, it's not like we get better health outcomes. It's not like we're giving better health care. So there is some gross inefficiencies that can be solved partly by technology, but partly by a single-payer system going at all the increased costs.
So what is your sort of big picture understanding of why that is? Why is the spending volume in the United States so high when the outcomes don't seem particularly good?
My understanding comes from Elizabeth Rosenthal's book, American Sickness. So it's a book I highly recommend, where she looks at both the role of hospitals and the profits that hospitals are making with charging a facility fee. In other words, we've all had the experience that if you go to a doctor's office and get a procedure, and if you get that same procedure at an urgent care or at a hospital, the hospital cost will be 10 times as much as the doctor's office, because these hospitals basically have a facility fee baked in. And some of these hospital CEOs are making $2 million, $3 million, $6 million. So looking at the hospital costs, looking at insurance costs, and how much Aetna CEO, who's paying for the $59 million that that CEO is making, looking at the costs of pharmaceuticals and the extraordinary profits that some of the pharmaceutical companies are making because of patents, and then looking to some extent at the cost of doctors and salaries of doctors. But I think that the whole system has been gamed towards benefiting certain private sector actors.
So do you buy the argument, though, that we get some useful innovation, for example, in the pharma sector or in the medical devices sector from the fact that we are paying these high prices? I mean, there are big profits there, but those profits drive investment, and that if we sort of go down to international norms, that that will sort of kill the goose that lays the innovation eggs?
No, partly because I think international prices may go up if we shouldn't be bearing the brunt of it. Second,
America first.
There's a NIH study that shows 216 of the 216 drugs in the last 5 years that got FDA approval started with NIH funding. So you also have a question of what is the balance, right? If we have savings from the federal government because we aren't paying as much through Medicare for drugs to the private sector, and you directed all of that funding to doubling the NIH budget, then you could argue that, okay, there'll be less private sector spending, but we're going to have all these more investment in Nobel laureates. I guess the answer is unclear to me whether that would lead to more or less innovation. Third, there's a professor, Darren Acemoglu at MIT, who had a great paper, who argues, yes, if you're spending more money in the private sector, yes, marginally, you're getting more innovation, but it's not innovation necessarily that's public health directed. So you may be getting a lot of innovation in something that helps me sneeze less or makes my skin less dry, but that doesn't mean that it's actually tackling the massive public health problems for the world or for our nation. And so you may want to have some public direction of that. And then the final point is, at some point, there's a question of equity. And, and even if you have some slight trade-off, I think the balance right now has been tilted so far away from equity.
Right. And I mean, you know, so, right, you're saying when you have a market-driven system, right, it encourages you to develop a medication that marginally improves on a problem that a large number of relatively affluent people have.
That's
right?
That's a clearer way of putting what I was trying to say.
Because it's good, right? Yeah. So it's like, I don't know, like nobody likes acne. Right? So it's
I was thinking the same thing.
So it's like if you make an acne medication that's a little bit better than the current best one, you can sell a lot of that.
Right.
But if you look like big picture, is this like a pressing social problem?
Exactly.
It's not great, right? Like if you could wave a magic wand and fix it, you would.
Right.
But like intense, like life-threatening illnesses that impact relatively small numbers of people just don't drive that much investment because the market's not big.
Exactly. And so if you're looking at having greater public investment in the research there and public incentives to companies to take that to market because you can't just have scientists, then that may be a good policy.
Right. So we could drive the research at problems of social significance. Right.
I mean, I guess my view of the markets versus the government is that the government tends to do disruptive innovation that doesn't have immediate returns well. And, you know, one of the things that bothers me so much is when people just disparage the government. And I said, the government has been one of the greatest engines of economic growth, our government in history, right? We created the satellites, we created the internet, we created GPS, we sent a person to the moon, we have instituted one of the most remarkable sets of rules of law. And so the fact is that the government is capable of doing an extraordinary amount, even in the issue of innovation.
So, okay, let's talk a little bit of politics here. So you are a supporter of Bernie Sanders' campaign.
I am. Proud supporter.
Does Bernie like this bill, like this idea, federalism?
I haven't talked to him about it. My assumption is that he would be supportive. I mean, he would say we need to, on day one, fight for Medicare for all. But if I told him that, look, Vermont may have had a better chance of succeeding based on this, I don't think he would oppose the idea.
Sure. But you're talking, this is like I don't quite want to say a fallback, but you are looking in a world where there may not be majority support in Congress for that kind of comprehensive legislation.
I'm looking at a world where we've won in Medicare for All since Harry Truman, where Jimmy Carter campaigned on it in 1976, and we still are nowhere close to getting it. And so I'm saying we need to have activism across states. We have to have activism across the country, and we need an all-of-the-above approach. And it would be probably naive to think that we're going to have a moment that everything is going to be done without state activism being allowed as mm-hmm. well.
Before I let you go, I usually like to ask guests here, what do you wish I had asked you here? What should we have been talking about?
I wish we were talking about why the politics of Medicare for All have become controversial given our Democratic history. I mean, when you have people like Ted Kennedy and Jimmy Carter both running on this, and it being assumptive back in the 70s that this was going to save money and this was the goal of the Democratic Party from Harry Truman on. When you have Daniel Patrick Moynihan, after all the Clinton hearings, turning to Lawrence O'Donnell, his aide, and saying, well, I guess the only thing that's going to work is getting rid of 65 for the Medicare statute and having Medicare for All. It's surprising to me that in the year 2020, we're still having a debate that that is the goal of progressives.
So what do you think accounts for that? I mean, why the change? Because you're right. I mean, a lot has gotten done on health policy in the past 20 years, but it does seem like what used to be, I don't want to say uncontroversial, but it was like the standard thing that progressive Democrats would say has now become a hot button.
Right. I mean, it was funny to me when President Obama, who I have enormous admiration for, described Medicare for All as one of the good new ideas of the progressives. And, you know, this idea is one of the oldest ideas of the Democratic Party. But I guess my—and there are probably smarter people than me who have thought about this, but my sense is that there's so much of the federal GDP that is now tied up with this, 17% of the economy. And it was probably a much smaller number in the 1970s. So transforming a much larger sector of the private sector and having much more profits that are at stake have made the politics far more complicated than they were in the 70s.
Right. But you think that's not a good reason to change the goal?
No, I don't think it's a good reason. I think it's just a reason of more special interest and more special interest from a crass political perspective and from an intellectual perspective, having the government rearrange a larger sector of the economy is always more difficult. So it's almost like where the goal, every year we don't achieve the goal, is probably making the goal harder given the inflationary costs of healthcare.
All right, fantastic. Congressman Ro Khanna, thank you so much for joining us. Thanks as always to our sponsors, our engineer, Malachi Brodus, our producer, Jackson Bierfeldt, and The Weeds will be back on Tuesday.
Hi, we're Visible. We're the wireless company with nothing to hide. Seriously. Hidden fees? We don't have them. Annual contracts? Not our thing. Great wireless on just one line? Now that's more like it. Get unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon for just $25 a month. Taxes and fees included. That's right, $25 a month, every month. Sorry, hidden fees. We're just not that into you. Sometimes the choice is just Visible. Switch today at Visible.com. Rate with service on the Visible plan. For additional terms and network management practices, see Visible.com.